What is in her mind? She put her fist through the window pane. It was such a funny feeling. It's so cold in Alaska. It's so cold in Alaska. It's so cold in Alaska.
Have you seen abusive behaviors in relationships?
Controlling you, who you see, when you go out, what you're doing when you're out of sight, it's not okay.
Putting you down, criticizing you, yelling at you or humiliating you, it's not okay.
Hurting you, losing their temper, getting violent, making threats against you, your family, or themselves, it's not okay.
Making you blame yourself. It's your fault for starting this. Making them mad. You deserve the mistreatment. It isn't true, and it's not okay.
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 It's not okay. Domestic violence hurts everyone.
Thank you. Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Welcome, everybody. We're down to just the last two shows of the year, and in one sense, the news has been kind of slow the last few days, but in another sense, we have entered what is maybe the craziest time since the start of the pandemic in terms of the coming together of, number one, extreme pandemic fatigue, number two, an outrageously contagious variant with record number of cases, which officially are not even close to what the real number of infections is, and we will talk to that. And it is abundantly clear that the next, I would say, 6 to 8 weeks are going to be extremely, extremely unstable in terms of the range of the sorts of reports that we're going to get. So, I mean, let's just go through it. As predicted, the extremely contagious Omicron variant is rip-roaring its way through the United States. Record numbers of cases over the last couple of days as the data from the holiday weekend has been processed. We had on yesterday 313,000 cases officially reported. Now, it's a crucial detail to understand. This is nowhere close to the real number. If you do an at-home test and are positive, and then you don't go and get a PCR at some location that officially reports these numbers, that positive home case doesn't show up in these numbers. In addition, because somewhere between 40 and 60% of Omicron infections are completely asymptomatic or almost completely asymptomatic, you might have a slight headache, little scratchy throat, not even something that would say to you, I've got to go get tested. A ton of people aren't even getting tested, never mind only getting a home test. So, you know, Dr. Fauci talked about we might see a million cases a day in the United States. We may be there already. When you have 312,000 officially reported cases, you can conservatively assume that between home positive tests and people who don't even get tested, you've got at least two times that number, which would put us at about 650, maybe even three times that number. So these are completely incredible numbers. Other signs that this is absolutely everywhere include positivity rates in some places. New York City now has a positivity rate of almost 20%, meaning if you go and just look at the percentage of tests that are coming back positive, it's about 1 out of 5. Almost 1 in 5 New Yorkers who took COVID tests received positive results in the latest batch of data. The latest case count is a drop, but overall testing surged ahead of the holidays, skewing the figures. In England, there's a report that if you have cold symptoms, right, if you look at this is now not a subset of people getting tested. This is a subset of just people with cold symptoms. Half of them are believed to have COVID, the Omicron variant, which is now dominant in the UK. Now, on that note, Omicron being dominant, this is the next level of chaos. If you've been following the question, what percentage of American cases are Omicron versus Delta? There was a report from about, I want to say 10 days ago, which said something like 75% of US cases were then Omicron, suggesting that by now it's got to be close to 100%. Not so fast. That data was mistaken. There is now a new report from the CDC which cuts the estimate of the prevalence of Omicron in the United States. Omicron is growing dramatically in the US, but the numbers we got were wrong. The CDC revised downward the estimate of the percentage of COVID that is now Omicron. According to agency data, Omicron accounted for 59% of all infections as of December 25th. Now, remember, the week of the 18th, they said Omicron is already 73%. Turns out that was only 22%, and the number is now 59%. So is Omicron more contagious than Delta? Yes. Is it increasingly a larger share of all U.S. cases? Yes. But the numbers were wrong. The numbers that we originally got were wrong, and the new estimates, as The Hill writes, mean that while a majority of new infections are Omicron, Delta has not been sidelined and is still about 41% of infections. So that is again another change, which is we thought that by now it would be all Omicron. It turns out that it is not. As of a few days ago, it was about 60%, meaning 40% of cases are still Delta. Delta and Omicron presenting with different severity, different symptoms, different level of vaccine evasion. Another element of chaos is the CDC deciding to change the quarantine and the isolation guidelines. And what I initially suspected was a change mostly motivated by economics and finance, and meaning we just, industry wants people working, seems to be exactly that. And so much confusion over these new guidelines. The CDC has shortened recommended isolation and quarantine periods for the general population. The CDC is sort of saying it's medically oriented, although many doctors are saying it's not really clear that there's a medical justification here. There's a debate about that right now. The new rules are, CDC is shortening the recommended time for isolation from 10 days to 5 days if you have COVID, if you are asymptomatic, followed by 5 days of wearing a mask around others. The change is motivated by science demonstrating that the majority of transmission is happening early in the 1 to 2 days prior to symptoms and 2 to 3 days after. Of course, if you don't have symptoms, it's hard to say which are the 1 to 2 days before and 2 to 3 days after. So this is the confusion. The guideline now is if you test positive, isolate 5 days. If you're still asymptomatic, leave isolation, keep masking for 5 days. Additionally, the CDC has updated the quarantine period for those exposed, not infected. If you're unvaccinated or more than 6 months out from your second dose and not boosted, quarantine 5 days and then wear a mask for 5 days. If it's not feasible to quarantine, wear a mask for 10 days. If you've had your booster, you don't need to quarantine after the exposure, but still wear a mask for 10 days. And for all exposed, get a test at day 5. If symptoms start, quarantine immediately until you get a negative test or can confirm that your symptoms are not due to COVID. The immediate question is this just a business thing? And Dr. Rochelle Walensky appeared yesterday on CNN. First of all, was asked, why are we not demanding a negative test? Listen to what she had to say.
The UK has also shortened its period of isolation to 7 days, but with a negative test on day 6 and day 7, a negative rapid test. Why didn't the CDC recommend taking a rapid test after those 5 days?
Yeah, really important question. So we do, just to be clear, recommend having a rapid test during your period of quarantine after you've been exposed. But we opted not
for
to
isolation.
Have that rapid test. For isolation, exactly. We opted not to have the rapid test for isolation because we actually don't know how our rapid tests perform and how well they predict whether you're transmissible during the end of disease. The FDA has not authorized them for that use. We don't know how they perform.
So this is a really important point. These rapid tests that many of us have relied on, they really are more accurate when one is symptomatic. And I'm going to talk today about I faced off against Omicron, and I'm going to tell you about it. And rapid tests are a big part of what I'm going to talk about. So Dr. Rochelle Walensky saying, you know, if you're asymptomatic in these cases, it's not really clear how much the rapid tests actually tell us. And then the question comes about, are these new recommendations medically oriented or business oriented?
So from what you're saying, it sounds like this decision had just as much to do with business as it did with the science.
Well, so it really had a lot to do with what we thought people would be able to tolerate. We have seen relatively low rates of isolation for all of this pandemic. Some science has demonstrated less than a third of people are isolating when they need to. And so we really want to make sure that we had guidance in this moment where we were going to have a lot of disease that could be adhered to, that people were willing to adhere to, and that spoke specifically to when people were maximally infectious.
Yeah. So there is no doubt that a big piece of this is just what are people willing to tolerate, quite frankly. And so I am not blaming anyone for any particular wrongdoing. I'm pointing out that the case numbers are so out of control. It is not clear we can vaccinate our way out of infection. We can hopefully vaccinate our way out of serious illness and death. Although, when I tell you my story later, you might change your mind about that as well. We'll get to that. Let's next talk about the domestic travel vaccine requirement. Starting 2 days ago, there was this question. What about a domestic travel vaccine requirement to get on a plane? Simply to get on a plane in the U.S. from one coast to another, not internationally. What about requiring vaccines? Major controversial aspect that is being considered. Dr. Fauci saying it would be reasonable, but I'm not saying one way or the other whether I'm recommending it. The latest news is that Joe Biden now says if his medical team advises it, he will issue the domestic travel vaccine requirement, and the anti-vax people are going absolutely nuts. President Joe Biden said yesterday he would impose a mandate that Americans must be vaccinated against COVID to travel domestically if his medical team recommends it. When asked when he would make a decision on that, he said, when I get a recommendation from the medical team. The idea of mandating COVID vaccines for domestic travel has been bouncing around for months. The emergence of the Omicron variant caused the White House to revisit this question. Biden said last month he would wait for the scientific community to give him a recommendation. Fauci said Monday, anything that could get people more vaccinated would be welcome. And said that it would be reasonable, but that he doesn't necessarily expect it. He said, I doubt if we're going to see something like that in the reasonably foreseeable future. Jen Psaki last month said it's not being taken off the table, but it will depend on the medical and health experts. So there's two interpretations of this medical and health expert thing. On the one hand, it's very refreshing after the prior 4 years to hear a president say, I'm going to listen to the medical team. It's not about what I want. That's great. At the same time, Joe Biden has sometimes used this, I will wait for recommendations, to really just do nothing. And we've seen that used in a couple of different instances outside of COVID. I think it's really important just to be honest about what such a mandate would achieve and what it would not achieve. This, if you do a vaccine travel mandate, the biggest accomplishment that it would push is getting more people vaccinated. We have seen that when people are polled about would this or that convince you to get a vaccine, this is polling people who have not yet been vaccinated. And at this point, the vaccines have been available so long that there's real questions about, you know, what if anything would get those people motivated. The $100 bonus was not a big motivating factor. But when people were asked, if you were required to have a vaccine to fly, would that make you go and get vaccinated? And that was the one stipulation that got the highest number of people to say I would. And it was something like 40% in a poll a couple of months ago. So such a requirement would get a lot more people vaccinated, I believe. At the same time, right now, as Omicron becomes a larger and larger share of the infections, the effect on keeping infections down is going to be modest. It will be greater than zero. There's no doubt about it. It's believed that, in fact, actually, that if you have three doses, you are up to 75% protected against symptomatic COVID. But there is a real question as to what it will do overall for spread versus keeping people out of the hospital and alive. And it will do a lot as far as that is concerned. It would be crushing politically, I believe, to Joe Biden in the media to do a vaccine travel requirement domestically. But if you look at the polling of what people think just generally in the general population, it's not an unpopular provision. I think this is one of those things where if there were to be a domestic vaccine travel requirement, right-wing media would go crazy and there would be some very loud voices saying it's absolutely terrible. But the country seems sort of 50-50 on such a requirement. And half the country already hates Joe Biden. I think it's basically the same half. I think a lot of the people that already hate him are the people against the vaccine travel requirement. So it is not something I actually expect to see anytime soon. But Joe Biden says he would certainly be willing. Let me know if you think it's something we will see. I do not believe we will see that anytime soon. Remember that on January 1st, we will be doing our 2022 midterm kickoff membership special. This is going to be a harebrained discount. If you've been thinking about getting a membership and all the great perks that come with it, including the daily bonus show, just get on my newsletter at davidpakman.com. You'll get an email on January 1st. You'll be able to sign up at that great discount. And hoping to kick off 2022 in big fashion, very, very big from the standpoint of memberships. Remember that the David Pakman Show is primarily funded by viewers and listeners like you. We have a membership program. You can sign up at joinpakman.com, and the benefits are extensive. We do an extra show every single day called The Bonus Show for our members. Every day, there's an extra 15 to 20 minutes of programming in audio or video format just for you. You also get commercial-free audio and video streams of the show. And when we do these, recently they've been monthly viewer town halls. We did one last night, in fact. Our website members get priority access to participate in the town hall, somewhere between a 6 and 8 time higher probability of getting on with me during the town hall. So sign up at joinpakman.com. You can use the coupon code BETTER21, 21 almost being over, almost 22 now. Coupon code BETTER21 to get a roughly, I think it's like a 40% discount. It's pretty solid. You know, we talked about during the Trump administration, one of the big accomplishments that took place was Donald Trump getting a whole bunch of different judges confirmed. Three Supreme Court justices aside, getting so many different judges confirmed who will shape the judiciary in a right-wing direction. Trump getting ideologues and completely unqualified people confirmed to different judgeships. And it's important to keep track of whether Joe Biden is able to accomplish anything similar. And to some degree, he has been. Now, I'm going to give you the story first, and then I'm going to give you the two perspectives on this, because there are people who are saying this is great, and there are people who are saying this is really nothing. The headline is Joe Biden is finishing the year with the most confirmed judicial picks dating all the way back to Ronald Reagan, outdoing Donald Trump, certainly. Reuters writes, President Joe Biden is wrapping up the year with more judges confirmed to the federal bench than any first-year president since Ronald Reagan. And experts say a growing list of judicial vacancies could allow him to do even better in 2022. The Senate confirmed 40, or 40, as Joe Biden likes to say, of Biden's judicial nominees, including 11 appellate picks, despite early concerns among progressives that he would lack opportunities to fill seats on nation's 13 circuit courts. Biden inherited just 2 appellate vacancies. Trump had 17, and that helped Trump make a near record 234 federal court appointments over 4 years. We're just talking about the first year here. As Democratic appointed judges elected to go into semi-retirement, Biden gained the opportunity to appoint many. The White House says 78% were women, 53% people of color. More are expected. There's going to be votes on January 3rd, and there's going to be a whole bunch more. Biden nominated 73 district and circuit court judges overall. His 40 surpassed Trump's 18 in his first year. So there's two different interpretations to this. And you might be thinking, how could this be bad? Okay. So on the one hand, the one side of this is bad is that this was mostly moderates being replaced by moderates. So the effect is that even though Joe Biden is replacing people and getting people confirmed, Trump was putting people in that were primarily ideologically kooky for the right wing. So while Joe Biden has a high number for the first year, he's replacing moderates with moderates. These are not ideological nutcases that in any way, they're not ideological nutcases on the right. They are also not progressives who are going to push the judiciary or pull the judiciary back to the left in any way, right? This is the devil's advocate. Trump was able to actually change the judiciary and pull it significantly to the right. And where Joe Biden is racking up confirmations, they don't really do anything to undo that because it's replacing moderates with moderates. Okay, that's the kind of pessimistic devil's advocate perspective. The other interpretation would be We don't want to go low the way they go low. We don't want Joe Biden electing equally or nominating and having confirmed equally incompetent left-wing ideologues. We want Joe Biden putting in competent people. And everybody that Joe Biden has selected has had no competency issue, whereas Donald Trump was selecting nuts in many of these cases, completely unqualified people. Both can be true is the truth. And we've said before, when the system is what it is, you have to work within the system and get what you can out of it. This is why until we change the way redistricting is done, for example, both Democrats and Republicans will gerrymander to their advantage as much as they can if and when given the opportunity. And we need to change the system. OK, that's one example. This is a different situation in my mind. And I don't want Joe Biden selecting the equivalent on the left of the right wing nutty ideologues that Donald Trump regularly selected. So I do see this as a good thing. And the question is going to be, can Joe Biden continue this? Remember that Donald Trump's number was 243 judges in 4 years. And he got three Supreme Court justices, one of which should have been Barack Obama's selection of Merrick Garland, which we've talked about ad nauseum. And I'm not going to sort of refresh for you at this point in time. But let's try to keep it going and let's see what the tally is in another year. But it is an accomplishment. There's no question that it is an accomplishment. And it is also true that it is mostly the replacement of competent moderates with other competent moderates. You tell me how major of an accomplishment you believe it to be. Rand Paul, the Republican senator from Kentucky, is being absolutely ridiculed for saying, look, here's how Democrats are stealing elections. And when you go and you read, you see, oh, Democrats are stealing elections by convincing voters to vote for them and encouraging voters to go out and vote or to vote absentee or to determine how it is that they plan to vote. It's amazing that he even thought this was a logical thing to put out there. So Rand Paul tweeted out 2 days ago a link to an article in The American Conservative. Okay, the article we're going to look at, it's called The Wisconsin Purchase. And a lot of the article is about Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, and the Center for Technology and Civic Life's involvement in Wisconsin. Okay. And Rand Paul tweeted out a quote from the article, adding how to steal an election. So Rand Paul says, how to steal an election, quote, seeding an area heavy with potential Democratic votes, with as many absentee ballots as possible, targeting and convincing potential voters to complete them in a legally valid way, and then harvesting and counting the results. This is called elections. This is called elections. Look at what Rand Paul is saying. The way that Democrats have used trickery to win is figuring out where are there lots of Democrats who might vote, but they might not, going there, convincing them to vote, and having them fill out absentee ballots in a legally valid way. In other words, voting, running an election. And it really is worth looking at the actual article that is linked to. And there is stuff, if you look at the article in sum total, you will find a bunch of stuff here about the influence of money, electioneering, Mark Zuckerberg, grants, using entities to shield one's personal, like there's a whole bunch of stuff in here that is not the way I would like to see elections run, but it is legal and it is part of the sort of status quo campaign finance structure that Republicans, generally speaking, are absolutely fine with. But then the incredible part is you look at the strategy and it's called running an election. So there's a heading called How the Wisconsin Five Sought to Implement the Wisconsin Safe Voting Plan. And it says the Wisconsin Safe Voting Plan lists four major strategic objectives. First, encourage and increase absentee voting by mail and early in person, mainly through providing assistance in completing absentee ballots and submitting them and installing ballot drop boxes. There's nothing ominous there. It's make sure that people have places to drop off ballots, make sure people know how to fill out their ballots. Completely legal. It's called voter engagement. Second, dramatically expand strategic voter education and outreach efforts, particularly to historically disenfranchised residents. This is their smoking gun, where the strategy literally is do outreach, particularly to groups that have been historically disenfranchised, so that they know how to vote, where to vote, what their options are for voting, how to get absentee ballots. Wow. How dark and ominous. Third, recruit election workers, mainly from paid young activists who would replace the usual older election day volunteers. Get young people involved. Typically, these election day volunteers are older. That's a reality. Get young people involved. Completely legal. Completely good. And a distant fourth in emphasis and level of funding was fund COVID-19 safety related, COVID-19 related safety measures. Nothing remotely concerning there. Just nothing remotely concerning there. They also, in the article, put in italics as if this is the smoking gun, and this is the part that Rand Paul tweeted out. But all of the resources developed toward ballot curing, drop boxes, vote navigators, partisan activists infiltrating local election office, etc., were aimed at one ultimate end. Here's their big smoking gun. As Rand Paul tweeted, seeding an area heavy with potential Democratic votes with as many absentee ballots as possible, targeting and convincing potential voters to complete them in a legally valid way, then harvesting and counting the results. This is what we call voting. This is what we call running an election. And per Rand Paul's explanation, here is Stacey Abrams, who is also listed in this article, explaining how to, quote, steal the election. And by that, I mean working to win the hearts and minds of voters so that they vote for you. Here is Stacey Abrams.
Now, you have long been a major voting rights advocate, but we are seeing a lot of new laws restricting voting, not just in Georgia, but across the country. So how are you going to tackle this and keep up this fight in 2022?
I'm excited to know that when the Senate comes back into session in January, the U.S. Senate is going to take up the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. These are two critical laws that will help protect voting rights across the country, because it's not about partisanship. This is about patriotism. My issue isn't who gets to vote. It's that everyone who is eligible is allowed to vote. My job as a candidate, of course, is to convince them to vote for me. But my job as an American is to ensure that every eligible voter has the right and the ability to cast a ballot.
So the important takeaway here is that for the Republican Party, this hasn't been the strategy for a decade. They are presenting as some kind of concerning or disturbing strategy, making sure people have the wherewithal and resources to vote, encouraging them to do so, and targeting areas where there's lots of potential voters for your side. That's called running an election. Republicans haven't done that for at least a decade. They essentially gave up trying to convince voters on policy in 2012 with Mitt Romney. You still had it a little bit when Mitt Romney ran against Barack Obama. They still sort of were running on policy, although the policy was increasingly vague and amorphous. In 2016, it was completely abandoned. Policy was completely abandoned. Trump still said things that sounded like policy, but it was not actually policy. The 2018 midterm, then, Republicans just straight up abandoned policy. In 2020, running on policy was a distant memory, and there's no indication that in 2022, Republicans are going to run on policy. They're going to run on trying to make it difficult to vote. And this is what they've been doing. Make it difficult to vote, particularly for people that are not likely to vote for you, and run on cultural issues, critical race theory, etc. You guys know the roster. So we have actually seen Democrats try to run on a platform of policy and voter enfranchisement. I'm not saying it's a platform I love in all ways. I've had no shortage of critiques and criticisms of the Democratic platform, but It's been, let's try to get people to want to vote, and let's use policy rather than cultural issues to do that. And Republicans running on cultural issues, running on fear, if you don't vote for us, brown people are going to invade from the southern border. We're going to take away, what was it Trump said? They would give you toilets that you have to flush 10 to 15 times and take away indoor heating and cooling and all these different things. We'll protect the suburbs, right? Extremely racially coded language. We'll protect you from people taking your jobs and, you know, raping and all these different things. So now when you actually just run normal elections, it ends up being presented as this is how they are trying to steal the election. This is called running an election. This is called politics, and just another completely humiliating public statement by Senator Rand Paul. We'll have it. We'll have that tweet of his and more coverage of this on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. You can also follow me on Instagram at David.Pakman. All right, so this is sort of like a kind of keep track segment as we hear more and more about the people that knew and were involved in exactly what the plan was between the November 2020 election and January 6th, the day of the Trump riots, to try to steal the election from the guy who really won it, Joe Biden, and hand it over to Donald Trump in some kind of a, you can use the term coup or insurrection or whatever term you want to use. Every time we hear from another one of these Trump insiders, we realize it was much more premeditated than initially was believed. Although there's no question that, I mean, listen, if for the 6 months leading up to the election, they're basically telling us we're going to say the votes were invalid, we're going to say that it was all fraudulent, etc. If they tell you that for 6 months, you should believe that that's what they're going to do. And that's exactly what they did. But there is an incredible new article in the Daily Beast that now outlines Trump economic advisor Peter Navarro in an interview, straight up telling them what the plan was and how he coordinated with Stephen Bannon. Read the entire article. We're going to take a look at it. The article in the Daily Beast is called Trump Advisor Peter Navarro Lays Out How He and Bannon Planned to Overturn Biden's Electoral Win. And it's exactly what we believed and even worse. A former Trump White House official says he and right-wing provocateur Steve Bannon were behind the last-ditch effort to try to stop the certification of the 2020 election results and keep Trump in power. They even had a name for the plan called the Green Bay Sweep. In his recently published memoir, Peter Navarro, Trump's trade advisor, explains how he stayed in contact with Bannon as they put the Green Bay Sweep in motion with help from members of Congress loyal to the cause. But in an interview last week with the Daily Beast, Navarro shed additional light on his role and their coordination with politicians like Paul Gosar and Senator Ted Cruz. Quote, "We spent a lot of time lining up over 100 congressmen, including some senators. It started out perfectly. At 1 p.m., Gosar and Cruz did exactly what was expected of them. It was a perfect plan. It all predicated on peace and calm on Capitol Hill. We didn't even need protesters because we had over 100 congressmen committed to it." That commitment appeared as Congress was certifying the votes, you'll remember. Senator Cruz signed off on Gosar's official objection to counting Arizona's electoral ballots. Remember that there's this, this was an issue back in 2000 with Al Gore and George W. Bush in that election as well. The way that these objections work are that a member of the House rises an objection and then they are asked, do you have the support of a member of the Senate? And typically the answer is no. In this case, Cruz was the Senate guy who was going to sign on to that. Staffers for Cruz and Gosar did not respond for requests for comment. There's no public indication whether the January 6th committee wants testimony or documents from Cruz or Gosar, but they've only started to seek evidence. The last minute maneuvering never had any chance of actually decertifying the election results on its own, a point that Navarro quickly acknowledges. But their hope was to run the clock as long as possible, to increase pressure on Mike Pence to send electoral votes back to 6 contested states. Now, understand that every time we learn more about the plan, it's the same story that we are hearing. Now that we have the memo that was written by Eastman, the lawyer Eastman, and presented to the White House about how this all could work, one of the big three points that was made was make it so that we put pressure on Pence to either reject the electoral ballots from certain states, or even better, even more directly, even more aggressively, you could say, seat an alternative slate of electors. What they wanted Pence to do, and of course, most legal experts say Pence couldn't actually do this. What they wanted Pence to do was say, you know, in these different states, Arizona, I don't remember the full list, but it was like Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, maybe Nevada. They wanted Pence to say, well, you know what? We can't trust these numbers. And so instead of allowing the Democratic electors to vote because the Democratic candidate won the state, I am going to bring in an alternative slate of Republican electors who will cast their votes for Trump instead of Joe Biden. That was one idea. Pence couldn't really do that. The other idea that they floated was, okay, you don't bring an alternative slate of electors, but you say, because it's unclear who really won some of these states, we're just going to take those electors off the table. And what that does is it makes it so that the threshold for winning, instead of being 270 electoral votes, is some lower number, ideally a lower number, which Donald Trump did have. That was the other idea. So when we look at this article, we realize this is part of that same plan. It was all coordinated. The legal opinions that Trump had in front of him and the idea of putting Pence in a position to take action, it's the same thing that Peter Navarro and Steve Bannon were working on. What else do we have here? The Green Bay sweep was very well thought out. It was designed to get us 24 hours of televised hearings, but we thought that we could bypass the corporate media by getting this stuff televised. Navarro's part in the ploy was to provide the raw materials that came in the form of a three-part White House report called The Immaculate Deception and The Art of the Steal. My role was to provide the receipts for the 100 congressmen or so who would make their cases, who could rely in part on the body of evidence I'd collected to lay the legal predicate for the actions to be taken. And the article points out, ultimately, states have not found any evidence of electoral fraud above the norm, which is exceedingly small. I think it was it Wisconsin or Georgia that found, I think, 4 dead people voted, and I think 3 of them just died after submitting their votes. You know, we're talking about numbers like that. The next phase was up to Bannon, Navarro describes in his memoir. Steve Bannon's role was to figure out how to use this information, what he called the receipts, to overturn the election result. That's how Steve came up with the Green Bay sweep idea. The political and legal beauty of the strategy was this. By law, both the House and Senate must spend up to 2 hours of debate per state on each challenge. For the 6 battleground states, that would be as much as 24 hours of televised hearings. So that was the idea. Now, according to this plan, you can argue that the violence hurt the plan. And what I mean by that is part of the reason why the hearings didn't happen and you didn't have 24 hours, because remember, the day that 100,000 of you at simultaneously, it was actually about 1.3 million different people joined my coverage of the January 6th Trump riots. My expectation on that day was that we were going to see objection after objection after objection, each with 2 hours of debate, and that I would step away from the coverage and we would just stream the coverage and it was going to go into the night, 24 hours, maybe even 30 hours, we were thinking. The reason it didn't happen is because of the riots. And so one could make the case that this plan, although it wasn't going to work to steal the election, that this plan was derailed by the fact that the riots took place. Now, that would lead us to the question, well, then why would Trump incite the riots? Trump has an all of the above approach. Trump doesn't have the sophistication and the ability for abstract thinking to realize, well, this plan and the riot inciting could end up conflicting and causing a problem. Trump's idea is just do everything, do this and try to convince Pence and then, you know, cause chaos. And ultimately, because the debate stopped because of the risk, the physical risk of violence to members of the House and Senate, this ended up not happening. Now, this ultimately wasn't going to work, but it might have actually gotten them those 24 hours of TV coverage that they wanted. So again, it's all out in the open. They're admitting that this was the plan to steal an election that they did not actually win. I want to follow up on my coverage from earlier this week about conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and what has taken place over the last 4 or 5 days with Alex Jones is really remarkable, and it informs a number of different aspects of these coalitions that have been built over the last 4 years and their fragility, quite frankly. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones was a big Trump supporter for a long time. He's also a big anti-vax guy, spreading unhinged, debunked vaccine propaganda regularly for the last year, year and a half. Donald Trump recently made 2 very mild pro-vaccine comments. While he said, "I still oppose mandates and everybody has to have freedom," Donald Trump did say on stage with Bill O'Reilly, "I got the booster. The vaccines are good and the vaccines work." And then Donald Trump said to Candace Owens during an interview, "The people dying overwhelmingly are the unvaccinated. And the right, the anti-vax right, has gone crazy. Some of them now see Trump as a traitor." One of those people is conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. So we're going to look at a couple of clips and pay attention to the degree of fragility for these coalitions that immediately is made evident by Trump saying something so mild and milquetoast about vaccines. Here's the first clip. This one's from the weekend. We already played this one earlier in the week, but just for context.
This is an emergency Christmas Day warning to President Trump. You are either completely ignorant about the so-called vaccine gene therapy that you helped ram through with Operation Warp Speed, or you're one of the most evil men who has ever lived. To push this toxic poison on the public and to attack your constituents.
Now, just to be, I've been told it's really important that I do this so that our content doesn't get blocked. The vaccines are not gene therapies, and they are not poison.
And they simply try to save their lives and the lives of others. We're about to lay out the basic incontrovertible facts that what you told Candace Owens just a few days ago is nothing but a raft of dirty lies.
That is untrue. What Donald Trump said to Candace Owens actually is true. But let's look at some other examples of this. Here is Alex Jones losing his mind on Donald Trump for what he calls a satanic alien attack. A satanic alien attack.
Children with deadly poison everywhere that they know erases their immune system, and Trump is running around in his stupid red tie playing the part of the apprentice CEO.
It is important to know that the vaccine does not erase your immune system.
Telling everybody, oh, you're playing into their hands, not taking their shot. No, Trump! You are playing into their hands and destroying yourself and signing yourself on to the New World Order.
The vaccines are not part of a New World Order conspiracy.
Idiot Bill O'Reilly. What a pervert. Doesn't even know how to pick women up. It just.
Bill O'Reilly may be a pervert. That actually may be accurate.
It's all just an incredible joke. See, I just can't get mad on air anymore. You know, there's a Gregory's report. They just filed. It's so important. And so let's just air that. And I may just go to rebroadcast. I'm not trying to be dramatic here. I may just never come back. You know, I mean, seriously, just let everybody have what you want. Let Schiff and Pelosi rob you. Let them molest your children. Let them take your 4-year-olds away.
There is no evidence that Nancy Pelosi or Adam Schiff have ever or plan to molest any children.
Their genitals off. You love it. Everybody's too busy with their own life and their own thing and their own this and their own candy-ass BS to wake up out of the coma that there is a satanic, off-world, alien attack going on this planet.
The vaccines are not a satanic, off-world, alien attack. Okay, so understand how fragile these alliances are. These people have principles that they abandon as soon as reality conflicts with the principles. These people form coalitions that are so fragile that as soon as there is any difference of opinion, you have Alex Jones seemingly having a psychotic break. Look at this next clip. I mean, look at what is taking place here, because Trump said, hey, the vaccines are pretty good at protecting people from dying.
Persecuted for supporting Trump. It makes it 10 times worse, because I know Podesta's evil, and I know Hillary's evil, and I know Obama's evil, and I know Fauci's evil, and I know Bill Gates is evil, and I know they're all evil. But Trump did a lot of good, and I believed in him, and so the fact that he's done this makes it personal. It makes it hurt. Persecuted for supporting Trump.
So look at the triggering. Alex Jones, who, as he says, was a major Trump supporter, cannot handle Trump's mild support for vaccines. Let's look at just a couple more of these.
Or take credit for it. It's a great, what we've done is historic.
Pause again. Sign on to it. Take credit for it. Take his sign on. Believe it. I mean, hell, we're fighting Bill Gates and Fauci and Biden and the New World Order and Psaki and the Davos Group and Peter Daszak. And now we got Trump on their team.
So Trump now officially persona non grata, according to Alex Jones. Here's just one last thing. There's this this is pro-Trump activist Alison Steinberg, who was invited also onto InfoWars. She also now has turned on Trump. Check this out.
A lot of you are probably going to say, oh, well, I don't care what he does, because this is about medical freedom as long as we have the choice. He's not even giving you the choice. If you go to his hotel in New York, you have to show proof of papers.
Now, of course, proof of papers, by the way, proof of vaccination. Understand that nobody's forcing you to go to Trump's hotel. You have total choice. There's no obligation to go to Trump's hotel.
But how can you continue to blindly defend this man? I don't get it. Make it make sense, please. Trump do some great things while in office? Absolutely. Was I a supporter? I was a huge one. But there's no denying that what he is doing is evil.
So there it is. Just incredibly fragile alliances in the world of Trumpism. And the reality that we have to understand is that these people, when you don't really have principles to begin with, and that's one of the hallmarks of the Trumpist movement, which is part of why he won, is he activated people who had no idea about the political world, history, how politics works. Their first involvement in politics was, oh, I kind of like the stuff Trump said, I'm going to vote for him. And so when you don't really bring any principles in by which you evaluate the man that you end up idolizing almost like a deity, you don't even really have a political ideology against which to evaluate their future actions. And that's why you're seeing these very people immediately turn on Donald Trump. It's fascinating to see. And Alex Jones really, really seems to be struggling there. We're going to take a quick break and be back right after this. All right, this is a really serious story. You know, we talk about in the abstract how this escalated, coarsened, more kind of audacious and brazen extremist political rhetoric that has really gone public in a lot of ways since the start of Trumpism has real world consequences. These people are radicalized for real. And then they go out and they do things in the real world. The January 6th Trump riots were a really great example of that. These are people who in significant proportion existed online for a long time. And then they went out on January 6th and then they did horrible things. Monday night, there was a mass shooting that took place in Denver. And it turns out that the perpetrator, often in these things, we don't name the perpetrator. But in this case, the perpetrator was a known entity. The perpetrator was an individual with a known public white supremacist, alt-right, misogynistic platform or position. We are learning more and more about this shooter. Daily Beast article called Denver Gunman Left Online Trail of Hate tells you a lot of what you need to know. Lyndon McLeod, who police say killed 5 people in Denver on Monday, was an author dedicated to alt-right philosophies, including masculine supremacy, contrarian COVID beliefs, and targeted violence against the, quote, weak. McLeod appears to have operated a plethora of Twitter and Instagram accounts under the alias Roman McClay, which he used for his 3-book series, Sanction. In his posts, McLeod seemed to frequently use excerpts from his work to comment on current events, such as a COVID misinformation meme on Twitter featuring Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg and Microsoft founder Bill Gates. The meme featured the billionaires discussing their approach to the pandemic, with Gates being thanked for mandatory vaccinations, with Zuckerberg congratulated for a, quote, injectable nanoworm. McLeod, who was killed by a Lakewood police officer Monday after shooting her in the abdomen, captured the photo with a quote from one of his characters in his book series. It's not really a worm so much, however, I understand the point. He gleefully indicated some people required violence to be addressed. While discussing a 2014 YouTube video titled Mike Tyson Destroys Reporter on Twitter, McLeod, as his character, as his persona McClay, blasted the passive-aggressive reporter and praised Tyson for using direct aggression. During a press conference Tuesday, police confirmed that McLeod, who records showed owned his own tattoo parlor, targeted each of his victims. Right-wing rapper and social media personality, known as Zuby, hosted McClay on his podcast to discuss Sanction in 2019. The host claimed the book was blowing up Twitter, though he admitted he hadn't read it. Police say during a Tuesday press conference, McLeod previously was investigated, but they didn't comment on why. Kurt Barnes, a spokesman for the Denver police, told the Daily Beast he was not aware of the connection between McClay and McLeod, but would forward the information to investigators. There's a whole tweet history of this guy, including there's a tweet from 2018 where Chloe Valdari tweeted, Maya Angelou said that if a person is told they are nothing, then they will say, oh, you think I'm nothing? I will show you where nothing comes. Do you think it's coincidental that at a time when the left is condemning whiteness, neo-Nazi activity is going up on the right? And Roman McClay, which is believed to be this guy's online persona, said, finally, someone is saying this. Maybe Heather Hying will listen to you since she follows you. Good job. Pain demands a response. All of us have limbic systems and feel terrible when society hates us. Invisible Man by Ellison or Sanction. Same story, different race. So an entire online history of this guy. Another one of these instances where he wrote, I start with sexual dimorphism for a reason. Biology is our first clue. Then you look at thousands of years of religions from Norse to Jew, Christian, and Muslim, all demand female chastity. Then you ask modern men how they perceive unchaste women, three levels of analysis which align. So like typical kind of men's rights activist misogynistic stuff. So what's the takeaway here? What's the lesson? The lesson is that his fiction, the fiction that this guy fell for, was the foundation for his actions. And this stuff has real world impact. Also important, because I'm going to do this every time we cover a shooting now. This was a shooting on Monday. Okay, got a lot of attention. There were 110 other shootings on Monday in addition to this one. This is constant. This is a constant backdrop. Check out the specifics on gunviolencearchive.org. But this was one shooting we talked about, and there were 110 other shootings, not mass shootings, 110 other shootings of different kinds, some subset of that, mass shootings. It is a constant in the United States. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a sad voicemail from a guy whose sister appears to have lost it.
Hey, David, somehow me and my sister diverged on beliefs a couple years back, and now she is a hardcore anti-vaxxer, and she's got a habit of saying things so stupid that they baffle me, and I don't know how to respond. And she says these things with such conviction and authority that I don't have an immediate comeback.
Yeah.
And in her head, that makes her right. She thinks I can't say anything back because I'm wrong and she's right, when in reality, I don't even know where to begin explaining how dumb she sounds.
This is the Sam Harris thing from his podcast a couple months ago about why he hasn't done a debate with Brett Weinstein or whoever else. And Sam Harris has explained, it is really easy to start a series of small fires that are very difficult for even someone who's prepared to put out. And that as soon as someone goes, well, hold on, you think vaccines work? What about the Zimbabwean study that showed everybody got worms from the vaccine and then died of COVID anyway? And then you go, well, I don't know. I didn't see. Is that study legit? I'm not sure. I'm not exactly prepared. And then the person bringing it up feels emboldened as if they are right. That's exactly what Sam Harris described, which is what the caller is talking about here.
The latest example, the reason I'm calling you, she sent me a meme with a child and a father that says, "Dad, is Santa Claus fake?" And the dad says, "Of course not, son. Think of how many people would have to be in on it." And comparing Santa Claus to COVID-19, anyone with half a brain can see how stupid that is. I don't even know where to start trying to explain that to her.
You know, it I hate to say this to the caller, but it may not be worth trying to explain it. I mean, the question is, what would be your goal? Is it just to change her mind, or is it because you believe she's a node of disinformation? If it's the former, I may not even bother, because that is extremely weaponized disinformation. We've got a great bonus show for you today. We will talk about the passing of a former Senate leader, Harry Reid, at age 82, a very important historic political figure of the late 20th century in the Senate, I would say. Oklahoma Republicans are introducing a bill to limit how slavery is taught in schools, of course. And we will talk about Dr. Oz's campaign already off to a bad start. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Don't miss the second to last bonus show.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once-over.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
RCT, in sound, from way out.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo,
know DJ's in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Republican Party under Trump and his minions, he basically owns the party, they have been in the lead of trying to destroy the prospects for organized human life on Earth.
In a special broadcast, An Hour with Noam Chomsky, the world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author. We talk about the pandemic, the rise of proto-fascism in the United States, the climate emergency, and why he's concerned about Biden's provocative actions towards China.
The right measure is not increasing provocation, increasing the threat of an accidental development which could lead to devastating, even virtually terminal nuclear war. But that's the direction the Biden administration is following. Expansion of the Trump programs. Now that's the core of their foreign policy programs.
Today, Noam Chomsky for the hour. All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a special broadcast, An Hour with Noam Chomsky. The world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author just turned 93 years old. Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I recently interviewed Noam as part of Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary celebration. Noam Chomsky joined us from his home in Tucson, Arizona, where he teaches at the University of Arizona. We asked him about the state of the pandemic and why so many Americans have refused to get vaccinated.
Overwhelmingly a far-right phenomenon. Others have been drawn in. And I think there are many sources. Actually, one of them is probably social media, which does circulate lots of dubious or even false information. And if people are wedded to a particular part of it, that's what they'll be fed. Beyond that, there is skepticism, which has justification about the role of government. Happens to be misplaced in this case, but you can understand the origins of the skepticism. And it's not just the pandemic. Much worse than that are the attitudes of skepticism about global warming. So one rather shocking fact that I learned recently is that during the Trump years, among Republicans, a belief that global warming is a serious problem, not even an urgent problem, just a serious problem, declined about 20%. That's very serious. Here we're talking not just about the spread of a pandemic, but about marching over the precipice and ending the prospects for sustained, organized human life. That's the kind of thing we're facing. Well, you can talk about the origins of the skepticism, but it has to be dealt with and overcome and very decisively and without delay, or else the whole human species and all the others that we are casually destroying will be in severe danger.
Noam, can you talk about how you think that skepticism can be overcome? I mean, you yourself, a serious critic of the you know, the corporate government alliance, why people should trust large pharmaceutical companies like Moderna.